every year they did a listing of the 10 worst clients. And Revlon was always number one. Always. I used to go to meetings, I would say, you make the mafia look like little girls. I used to say to my staff, we don't care what they say, leave your ego here. We are going to Revlon. Do not bring your ego along. If they say, I hate this, you don't have any talent, don't worry. That they say that to everybody. Ignore it.
Meet David Ledick.
My name is David Ledick. My middle initial is W, William, David W. Ledick. I was born in Michigan in January 14th, 1930, which makes me 91 years old, very recently. But here I am, entering the 10th decade. Not many people do.
David is an interesting fellow. He's been a Navy officer, a ballet dancer, a bigwig in advertising in the age of Mad Men, and a much published author. Well, that's certainly interesting, but to me, that was not the most interesting thing about him. David uses words like privy, and he knows what a Modigliani is. That'll be explained later. He's the kind of a guy you'd love to have at your dinner party. But again, that was not the most interesting thing about him from my perspective. David lives his life with enthusiasm. You can hear it in his voice from the moment you start to talk with him. And from what I can gather, he's as enthusiastic and engaged at 91 as he was at 19. Here's the thing. It's not a false cheeriness. It doesn't come from a life hack, like getting a good night's sleep or decluttering your house, although I would never speak against such things. David's enthusiasm comes from a notion, a thought, a paradigm shift that he articulated that I had not heard from anyone else I've spoken to for this podcast. I'm Leslie Gold. This is a life's story. David, tell me about your childhood.
My childhood was primarily much affected by the Great Depression of the 1930s. I was born in 1930. My parents lived in Detroit at that time. My father worked in the automobile industry. And with the Depression, he was fired. They didn't have any money. And my mother had just inherited her parents' home in a little town called Montague, Michigan, which is on the western shore of Lake Michigan. About a four-hour drive up from Detroit. So they moved there. At the present time is the oldest house in Montague. It was built in 1865. And when we moved in there, the only modernity in the house is they had electric light bulbs put into the lower floor, dangling on cords with no shade or anything. That was it. There was no modern bathroom in the house. There was a privy in the garden. There was a large wood-burning stove in the kitchen, and in colder weather, they brought another stove in and put it in the living room. That was the entire heating of the house. And when we went to bed upstairs, we took a hot water bottle. My mother was born in 1898, and I was brought up very much the same way she was.
How did your family get by financially if your father had been fired?
Actually, my mother was a school teacher, and she was sort of being used if they needed a guest teacher to come in, somebody was sick or something, she would go in and teach. So we had a little income from that. My father worked finally after I don't think he had any employment at all for several years, but then he finally got a job there was a local tannery. That was really the only business that was going on around there. And he was the night engineer. So my father worked from midnight till 8 or something like that, I guess, because I know that when we were small, he was sleeping all day, every day.
Were you a close family?
I would say my mother really didn't want her third and fourth child. My mother always said to me I was the only one of her children she could really speak to. So she would tell me, and she said that she was very, very kind of overwhelmed that she had this small child and they were in the Depression. And then she had was pregnant her fourth time with my sister.
So when your mother said she wasn't really into the third and fourth child, weren't you number three?
I was number three, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, so she was telling you.
She was telling me. We were very close. And I often tell people this. My older brothers and my father told me all the time that I wasn't very adequate, that I wasn't very smart, that I wasn't very capable. But I always ignored them. I was in a class. So I graduated with a class of 32 people. 19 of us had been together since kindergarten.
Wow.
In the same building. We all reassured each other all the time that we were great. And so I spent all those 13 years in a very, you know, I was with them more than I was with my own family, really awake and alive and doing something. So when I graduated feeling very self-confident and very capable because having been surrounded with people who liked me and whom I liked all those years was a very positive experience, very.
It's interesting that your father's words didn't undermine your self-assurance.
Well, we were seated at a round table, and I had to sit at the furthest distance from my father because he liked to strike us. Mm-hmm. And my oldest brother said, you know, you had to sit the furthest away from him because you, at 8 years old, you were smarter than he was. My father died when I was 11 of cancer, and he had been ill for several years before then. So we were in a very, you know, restricted household with a father that was very ill for a long, long time before he finally died. And I went to work when I was 13 as a gardener. And there was a lady, and I just wrote about this. Her name was Alice Merica. And on her mailbox on the street, it said A.Merica. So Mrs. Merica, I worked for her as a gardener starting at 13. And she had a rather extensive house and grounds in the town of Montague. But all her grounds and gardens and everything had to be taken care of whether she was there or not. So I would, you know, as soon as the snow was off the ground, I was taking care of her grounds.
Do you remember what you got paid?
I got paid $15 a week. Yes, I got paid $15 a week, and I had to go start her furnace fire every morning at 7 o'clock, even in no matter what the weather. She wanted the house heated up. Then I went home, had breakfast, went back to start work at 8. I worked from 8 to 6, 6 days a week.
For $15.
For $15. And then I later worked at Taft Nesbitt's Grocery as a grocery clerk. And then after that, I worked for my cousin of my mother in Whitehall, which was a little town immediately across the river from Montague. And so by the time I was 17, I graduated from high school and I had $1,000. I've saved, and that was enough to go to the University of Michigan for a year.
David paid his way through college.
My mother never spent one cent on my education. She never had to. In college, I got a job working as a correspondent to the Muskegon Chronicle. And I reported on what the college students from that Western Michigan area, where the Chronicle was distributed daily, were doing at the university. And I got paid by the inch. So I wrote very long articles and I earned pretty good money doing that. I'm very glad I went to the University of Michigan because it was the most international. There were people from all over the world there.
Were you able to graduate?
And I graduated from college. And then at that time, you were drafted or you joined a service. And a big number of my fraternity brothers were from Long Island. And they were all in the Naval Architecture School. And they all went and to a four-month training as to be naval officers. So I went with. They knew everything about boats, sailing, you know, and I knew nothing. Then we graduated from the four-month training as naval officers. We were ensigns, and they were all assigned to boat building centers. They never went to sea, ever. They were in the Navy for 3 years as ensigns and junior grade lieutenants. They never went to sea. I, who knew nothing, went to an aircraft carrier where I was a junior officer. And I did 19 crossings of the Pacific. We were on the deck being inspected by the captain. And we all had, and all the enlisted men had to have their ID tags out so that the captain, should he want to stop and talk to them, could look at their ID tag and see what their name was. And one of my men didn't have his ID tags. And the officers didn't have to display their ID tags. So I took mine off and put them on him so that he would be, you know, would not have any problems. Unless the captain did stop and ask him what his name was, which he did not. But they rallied behind me. My enlisted men rallied behind me. They realized I was just a front confrontation point for them, and they never let me down, ever.
This is not the last time that David runs interference for the people on his team. And in turn, he earns their admiration and loyalty.
After I had done 19 crossings, I was had been in a year and a half, and I was entitled to be reassigned. And I hated it. I thought, my God, I'm so tired of going back and forth across the Pacific. So I applied to go to cryptographic school, which was in Monterey, California, on the coast, and learned to be a cryptographic officer, which meant that I would receive messages in code and decode them. And I learned to become a decoding and coding officer. And I was then assigned to go to Bikini for the hydrogen bomb test.
Okay, so was this in the Marshall Islands where the U.S. detonated a bunch of nuclear weapons?
This was in, Bikini was in the South Pacific.
Okay.
And this was the hydrogen bomb. This was not the atomic. This was later.
Okay.
And this is the famous one where the first one was six times larger than they anticipated, and the wind carried it, and it contaminated Japanese fishing fleet, and many of the people in the fishing fleet died.
The observant fleet, all eyes are trained on the blast point. 25 seconds, 20 seconds, 15 seconds. Dr. Holloway, leader of the Los Alamos group, and the entire fleet waits in almost agonized tenseness. Now but 5 seconds to go, and... awful roar of the blast, equal to a discharge of 60,000 depth charges, each weighing 600 pounds, strikes the ears of the observers. Many miles away, the raging might of searing flame, crushing force, and deadly radioactive water is seen falling in a killing mist.
And it was a big hullabaloo.
Well, hullabaloo is one way to put it. Nuclear testing at Bikini Atoll consisted of the detonation of several nuclear or hydrogen bombs by the U.S. between 1946 and 1958 in the Marshall Islands. This was in the midst of the Cold War and the arms race with the Soviet Union. The bomb drop that David witnessed was a hydrogen bomb dropped from an aircraft above. Now, a hydrogen bomb has never been used in battle by any country. But the experts say it has the power to wipe out entire cities and kill significantly more people than the atomic bombs that the U.S. dropped in Japan during World War II. When this bomb exploded, it was brighter than 50,000 suns. At the time, it was the most powerful artificial explosion in history in terms of the energy being released. The blast was 1,000 times more powerful than each of the atomic bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima or Nagasaki during World War II.
We were 35 miles from the center of detonation, and when it went off, we looked, we had goggles. It was like a huge cauliflower. It wasn't like an atomic bomb at all. You know, it went up, it was kind of an umbrella. It was like a huge cauliflower, and it went to the margins of the ever as far as you could see to the left and the right. And then immediately we got a message which was not coded that said, leave immediately for Eniwetok. But Eniwetok was 120 miles away. Navy was conducting all these things and had no grasp of what it was doing. So we had ships, small ships that came and took the enlisted men who reported to me to one of the small islands that made the atoll of Bikini. And they were there allowed to go swimming in the contaminated waters of the atoll. So we were all thoroughly contaminated. And I have a nephew who says, that's the reason you're in such good health right now.
I built up your immune system to anything.
Yeah, I resisted that.
The fallout was widespread and toxic, the heaviest of which was in the form of pulverized surface coral from the detonation, and it fell on residents of other islands and atolls within a 350-mile radius of the blast, while the more particulate and gaseous fallout spread even further around the world. It was huge, a huge poisonous mess. The inhabitants of the islands were not evacuated until days later, and they suffered radiation sickness. Here is Bonnie DeBrun. She was on Likiap Atoll in the Marshall Islands, which is almost 300 miles away from Bikini Atoll, where the bomb exploded.
I saw them right in front of me while I was carrying my daughter. She was 8 months old that time. And I tried to catch what I saw coming down, like so many kinds of color. So many colors. Blue, yellow, red. And I tried to catch, I thought I might catch some of it. But when I tried to catch, I didn't see anything in my hand. But I saw them coming down, falling down. That's what. I didn't know that it was a poison.
Bonnie DeBrun developed thyroid cancer. She was lucky and survived it. However, many people on the island did die of cancer-related illnesses. Did the Navy ever make, for lack of a better word, reparations to either the people in Bikini Atoll? I'm sure there were some natives.
No, they have kind of ignored it. And I, at the moment, am in a suit pursuing the Naval Affairs Office over it because I have had many small lesions on my legs through the years that are precancerous. They're not cancerous. They're precancerous. But I've had them removed as soon as they appear for 25 years. So I feel that perhaps I should have some reparations, since I'm probably the only person left from that period of time at Bikini. I'm 91 and I was 23 at the time. My theory is that at 91, they figure if they stall around long enough, I'll drop dead.
What I've learned from doing this podcast is that is actually a good theory. Governments all over the world, not just the U.S. government, are loath to admit wrongdoing and generally only do it many decades after the offense. By that time, the victims of the wrongdoing are often long gone or there are very few left, and this limits both the liability and the public outcry on the matter. David leaves the Navy, comes home to the States, and makes a rather interesting career shift. How did you go from being a naval officer to a ballet dancer?
I went to New York. I had an aunt, Mary Brooks Picken, who had been married to my uncle, my mother's brother, and they had had a very successful advertising agency. He had died. She was still working, very kind of an important person in advertising, and she sent me out on 10 interviews as soon as I arrived, and I had two job offers in like 2 weeks, and I took the one on Park Avenue because I wanted to be uptown. I thought it was more glamorous than the one that was down on Wall Street, and I worked there about a year, and I realized all this leads to is what most people want, which is you make a lot of money, you live in a nice apartment, you do repetitious things, and you don't really experience and experiment with the things you would really like to do. And by a fluke, I had met friends, and she was a ballet dancer, and she was going to class. So I thought, well, I've always been interested. I'm going to go to class. Well, I went to class with her much of that year. You know, and when you're a ballet dancer, you must go to class every day, of course. And it turned out that, you know, I have great legs. And I do have great legs. And I said, a blonde with great legs, why shouldn't that person go somewhere? So I went and then I was fired. And I thought, this is destiny. This is destiny. The advertising agency hired a bunch of younger people to see which ones they liked best. And then they fired the ones they didn't want. So then I went, and it was exactly at the week that we registered to go to the training, to go to the ballet school at the Metropolitan Opera. So I went and registered, and I went. and I worked, and I did very well. And I made my debut, actually, with Maria Callas in Norma, and it was amazing. And all dancers will agree with this. You're standing in the wings, you're waiting for your cue to go on, the music is playing, the other dancers are out there, the audience is looking, and when the music hits a beat, you've got to go on. You cannot go back in the wings now, you cannot go home, you have to go on. It's terrifying. It's just terrifying.
She's more broadly referred to as Maria Callas, but I'll defer to David on the correct pronunciation. Maria Callas was by far the most famous and controversial operatic artist of her time. A singing actress with a unique intensity, she was adored by both public and critics alike for her vocal technique and her dramatic gifts. She was radiant, elegant, strong, and a little bit arrogant.
She was a fat girl that was stranded in Greece during the war, and she married a very, very wealthy man who decided he was going to have a star. She was not particularly friendly to anyone in the cast, never. And when she got on stage, she just lit that place up. She transfigured the audiences. The audiences would just fall out of their seats.
Interesting side note, Maria Callas, Callas, although she was still married, she fell desperately in love with Aristotle Onassis, a Greek shipping magnate, whose appearance would remind you of a mobster. Callas divorced her husband. Onassis, however, had no plans to leave his wife or family. He saw Maria Callas as a pastime, as someone he could have fun with whenever he had time. And although Onassis eventually divorced his wife, he never married Maria Callas. Instead, he married Jacqueline Kennedy, the widow of President John F. Kennedy. Maria Callas' life and career went into a sharp decline after that, and she died at only 53 years old. At the core, she died of a broken heart.
Was it that it was taking a physical toll on you when you decided to stop? No.
I realized I would not be a star.
Your goal?
Well, it has to be your goal in ballet because you're getting to be, you're 25, you're 26. People are coming on stage with you who are 19 and 20, and they can jump higher than you can. And they can turn faster than you can because there's a difference in age. You know, and you realize, okay, in a couple of years, I'm going to be 28, and then I'm going to be 30. And then when people are hiring the cast, they don't want a 28-year-old. They don't want a 30-year-old. You're going to have to go and teach ballet. And that will be what you will do the rest of your life. And I decided I'm too young. I have that kind of a destiny waiting. I was very good creatively in advertising. I knew how to put commercials together to present them, to make them look exciting. So I would cut magazine pictures out of Vogue magazine and things like that and make a big presentation and they would get quite excited. And then I did a famous campaign there called As Long As You're Up, Get Me a Grants. And Grant Scotch, we had Grant Scotch as a client. And I wrote, and I was one of my clients, and I wrote a campaign that said, as long as you're up, get me a grant. And then the advertising chief decided the illustration was a man sitting, typing with a typewriter on his lap. And then the copy said, as long as you're up, get me a grant. It's over there, you know, under the Modigliani. And it was all very, very, you had to be really upscale to know what the hell a Modigliani was.
I don't know.
It's a painter, famous painter. From Hakate, I went to a small agency that was being created by the mafia, and they wanted a really good, and my ad had gotten a lot of attention. People wrote about it, and so when I came in with my portfolio, and that was my big ad, they hired me. They made this agency, they put it together, and they sold it. I think they sold it to other mafia people. And they called me at home. about 8 o'clock in the evening and said, would you please come to the agency? Because the people that are purchasing the agency want to see you in person. And they said, dress up. And I was dressed by, you know, couture in France at the time. And I put on my best suit and went up there. And I went in and I just stepped in. And they stood me at the head of the table. And the table was circled by all these really tough looking guys. And they said, this is David Letick. And I said, good evening, gentlemen. And they said, that's enough. You may leave.
The mafia types just wanted to make sure that a creative director actually existed before they went ahead with the deal.
I went to Gray Advertising and I was the worldwide creative director for Revlon.
That was a big deal. It was the golden age of advertising. Our collective attention was focused on TV, print, and radio only. And there were only 3 major TV networks and everyone watched them all at the same time. When an ad pierced through and captured America's attention, it entered the zeitgeist in a huge way. People quoted these taglines, they sang the jingles, they talked about these ads, and the folks who made them were almost as famous as the ads themselves. Like Alka-Seltzer.
I can't believe I ate that whole thing.
You ate it, Ralph.
Calgon Water Softener.
How do you get shirts so clean, Mr. Lee?
Ancient Chinese secret.
Wendy's.
It's a very big, fluffy bun.
Where's the beef? Hey, where's the beef?
Coca-Cola.
I'd like to teach the world to sing. Sing with me. Perfect harmony. Perfect harmony. I'd like to buy the world a Coke and keep it company.
It was a time of big ideas, 3 martini lunches, and larger-than-life personalities who graced both the society pages and the business columns. So if being in advertising in the 60s, 70s, and 80s was considered glamorous, I have to imagine David was in the lane that made him extra glamorous because he wasn't selling cereal or margarine. He was selling beauty. Hi, it's Leslie. I hope you are enjoying this episode of A Life's Story so far. We can do this for you. We'll produce a personal audio documentary for a beloved family member. We will capture their life story and present it in a beautiful piece of audio storytelling that you and your family will treasure for years to come. Details are at the very end of this episode.
People don't know this. This world is gone completely. But Revlon at that time, the Advertising Age was the big magazine for the advertising industry. And every year they did a listing of the 10 worst clients. And Revlon was always number one. always.
Oh,
I used to go to meetings, I'd say, you make the mafia look like little girls.
We've gone into a bit of the history of makeup. David claims it was Wallace Simpson who gets credit for expanding makeup into the mainstream. Wallace Simpson being the twice-divorced American who caused the King of England, King Edward VIII, to abdicate his throne in 1937.
Should you wear a little bit of color on your lips, you went to the ladies' room to put it on. Well, Wallace Warfield had them design the compact. And the compact was a beauty. You know, it's like a piece of jewelry. And after lunch was over, she opened her compact and pulled out her lipstick and put her lipstick on at the table.
Scandal.
And it was scandalous. So that, once that happened, of course, all the society women immediately dashed over to Tiffany and got their compacts and started wearing lipstick. And then with lipstick, you had eyeshadow and mascara and all the rest of it. So the Revlon business boomed in coordination with Wallace Warfield Simpson's appearance in the late 1930s. Lots of married women wore Revlon because the Revlon woman was not a virgin. She was not married. She was a racy woman, and they loved. They weren't in any way. But when they wore a Revlon lipstick, they kind of identified with, you know, I'm kind of a sexier, more interesting person than people realize I wear Revlon. They were spending, this is in the 1960s, they were maybe spending $40 million a year on advertising. And the agency got 17%, which made them a big, big client.
A big, big client, but a punishing client.
People would come to a meeting with us sometimes, and they would come out and say, how can you do this every day? Because they would say, this is crap. I hate this. This is the worst advertising I ever saw in my life. You used to be talented. You aren't talented anymore. This is junk. Why does he have blah, blah, blah? I used to say to my staff, we don't care what they say. Leave your ego here. We are going to Revlon. Do not bring your ego along. If they say, I hate this, you don't have any talent, don't worry. That they say that to everybody. Ignore it.
Alex Kadem was a much-in-demand hair and makeup artist who worked with David on many Revlon ads.
And he told all of us, he says, hang on, they'll terrorize us, they'll torture us, but in the long run, they'll go with what I'm saying. Kept them on board for 20 years. He gave that security to him. He knew in the long run he was going to make them understand what he was talking about. He knew that they were going to expect him. It was a game. I have worked with other companies besides Revlon, many of them, just to name Dior and Lauder, and creative people were difficult then, you know, and they expected to be difficult. They expected us to be difficult too.
A little bit of history here. Revlon was run by Charles Revson, who founded the company. And Charles Revson turned a $300 investment into the largest retail cosmetics and fragrance manufacturing firm in the United States, with more than 3,000 products and annual sales at the time of his death in 1975 of $605 million. Now, David and the other creatives were responsible for coming up with the names for the new Revlon products. And David tells me of a particular challenge to come up with a name for a new perfume. Typically, Revlon would reject name after name after name because they're Revlon and they hated everything.
Name after name, nobody liked any name, nobody liked any name. And suddenly somebody thought of his Charles' son's name was John. So we named the fragrance John 2.
J- oh my God.
J-O-N-T-U-E. They bought it immediately.
I think I remember those ads. Were those the ones, they were kind of filmy with the horses?
Yes, 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 yes.
Oh my God, you did those?
I did all of those and they were very successful. But we never could really make any money in France because Jean Tu in French means John kills.
Come to find the beautiful fragrance of Jean Tu. Sensual, but not too far from innocence. Jean Tu, the beautiful fragrance. Sensual, but not too far from innocence. Jean Tu from Revlon. Wear it and be wonderful.
David likes to enjoy life and do things his way. Back then, that meant that he wanted to work only 32 weeks a year and spend the rest of his time in his second home in France.
And they said to Revlon, is it all right if your creative director only works 32 weeks a year? They said, we don't care when he's there. I would be in my home in the French countryside and they would call me and they would say, you have an 11 o'clock meeting tomorrow morning in New York with Revlon. I'd say, fine, I'll be there. And I would call Air France and I would book a flight the next morning on the Concorde, which only took 2.5 hours to cross the Atlantic. And then I would go up to my apartment in Paris in the afternoon. I would leave the next morning on the 11 o'clock flight for New York. It means you had to be at the airport at 10. And then the 11 o'clock flight arrived in New York at 9:30 in the morning. Because, you know, you're going against the clock. then we would arrive at 9:30 and I would go directly to Revlon. And we would have our meeting. I traveled without any luggage. And then I would go to the meeting at Revlon. We would discuss what had to be done. We would go back to the agency with my staff. I would explain to them what we were doing, what we had to get done, And I would leave to take the 7:30 flight back to Paris. There was a period in time when I actually think we were more modern than we are now.
After his tenure in advertising, David begins writing books. The first is The Male Nude, which was more of an ode to the male physique and a visual history of the male nude in photography from the beginning until modern times.
So I did a book called The Male Nude, and it was for a German publisher. And it was the entire history beginning, the very beginning, all through the 19th century up through the 20th century. And it was called The Brick, with 700 pages. And they sold zillions.
You become the established expert
on
the male
nude? And then I am the established expert on the male nude. I did perhaps four or five more books on that subject, different points of view, what we should do, or new photographers. I would do books where I would have maybe 10, 12 contemporary photographers, and we would get them all together, and they all had done very good male nudes. So people that were interested in the male nudes wanted those books. Those sales were, they got excellent sales. And then the publishers said, well, you know, David, if you want to write novels, we'll publish them. So I did, I've done 45 books.
45 books, obviously you have no problem with writer's block.
No, I can always write the sex parts.
A lot of the content of David's book came from his life philosophy, things he believes in and has been freely sharing with friends through the years. Alex Kadem, again.
I've learned from him as far as his attitude towards his age. He said, Alex, there's chronological age, there's emotional age. Subscribe to the second one, he said.
George Clark is a friend. They met years ago when David helped a young George get employment as a model at a time George's life needed a bit of direction. They've been friends for decades.
As I got into my 50s and 60s, he always said, my rule of thumb, George, is always your friend should be 20 years younger than you. And it wasn't a hard and fast rule. What he meant by that was hang with people who they themselves are still engaged and having fun and find things interesting, who haven't gotten to the point in their life where they think, well, I'm now 68, so therefore I better put my feet up. Maybe I better not exercise anymore because I mean, you know, there's none of that.
Just a little while ago, it was his 91st birthday, and we all got together to celebrate it for him in an open area in a restaurant garden. And we all gathered and we were waiting for him. He arrived in a bicycle with gloves on, helmet on, a scarf flying, and he jumped off this bicycle. I said to myself, my God, this man could have stepped off a flying saucer.
You don't stop to say, hey, you're now 80 or 90. Why are you doing X? That doesn't even pop into your head because he's doing it and enjoying it. There's no recognition of limitations, which would be artificial.
We are closing in on the paradigm that continues to drive David's enthusiasm and zest for life.
Maybe the last 30 years of your life are the best ones. Maybe, I said, you know, the whole idea that you slide downhill towards the end, that's not necessarily true. You're not, you know, you're in good health, you exercise, you're fine. You've never been to, you know, Alaska. Don't get on a plane. Go.
And that's it. Maybe the last 30 years of your life are the best. That notion is inextricably intertwined with David's enthusiasm. Young people tend to be more future-oriented. They think their whole life is ahead of them, hence they're full of excitement and enthusiasm. On the flip side, older people tend to think that their best days are in the past, so they have more enthusiasm for the past than for the future. But what if you did think that the last 30 years of your life are the best? To maintain a sense of youthful enthusiasm, you should believe that the best years are just ahead and that your life continues to be full of amazing possibilities.
He's as joyful now as he was 30, 40, 50 years ago. In terms of whatever he's doing, he's enjoying, and he's always pushing himself. So to me, I always find that fun. I always find that, and, you know, somewhat inspirational. Yeah, a couple of years ago, he said to me, so what do you want to do for your next career? And I was like, hey, I'm in my mid-60s now. I just want to retire. But it caught me, and he's absolutely right. Why couldn't I do something else? And more importantly, why shouldn't I do something else?
David, you have no regrets or few regrets?
None. I have none at all.
None?
None.
None. That's a big statement.
It is a very big statement, and I want to make it. I'm in my 11th career, and I have no regrets. I have not failed to live my life.
When people have regrets, real regrets,
yes,
they're usually things like bad choices in love or in work.
Married the wrong person.
Right. Or they were held back for fear, something
and
that
they
you
stayed
alluded
in,
to.
Stayed in the wrong job. They were offered a much better but more chancy job and they didn't take it.
Right. You have none of those.
None.
Wow.
Whatever he engages with, he engages with enthusiastically. And that's a very attractive trait in people.
I wondered about David's personal life.
I have had 4 great love affairs. I'm very romantic. I've never felt guilty about being homosexual because I had a boyfriend when I was 4. He was 5. He was always going to marry me when we grew up. And through the years, you know, through my teen years and so on, I would have romances with other high school students and things, boys. And by the time I was 20, I realized I didn't want to sleep around. A lot of gay men sleep around, sleep around, sleep around. And I didn't want to become that kind of a person.
You seem to have, over the years, embraced your age with both hands.
Yes.
Right? One of your books was How to Hit 70, Doing 100.
Yes.
And then, of course, the book that led me to you, which is 90 Lessons to Learn from a 90-Year-Old.
Yeah.
Are those lessons for other 90-Year-Olds or just for anybody?
Well, what I discovered that many, many, many people that have found the book very interesting are nowhere near 90. If it's for 90 years old, it's certainly for anybody up to 90.
So let's talk about some of the advice in the 90 Lessons to Learn from a 90-Year-Old.
Uh-huh.
One that struck me was you must always try to look good. And I love the word try in there.
Yes.
The word try made me chuckle. Because in my head, I heard somebody say, well, at least look like you're trying. So what did you mean by that? Why is that important?
Because I think there's a thing in our culture that at some point you become an older person. And nobody wants really to know an older person. So you become more and more isolated, lonelier, fewer friends, your friends die, and you're not, and you have to kind of, people are interested in knowing you by their first impression of you. When they first meet you, they have to kind of think of you as being an interesting, attractive person, maybe not in our age category, but not somebody that's an older person who's, there's a kind of a giving up thing that happens with people, and they think I'm just too old, and you have to avoid that. You have to think, no, the last 30 years of my life could be the best ones, and I have a lot in my book about how do you keep yourself looking good.
Well, lest you think that David's focus on looking good and staying youthful and being around younger people means he's superficial, I found that it's not so. I actually heard many stories of David reaching out to help someone at a time that they needed help, whether it be arranging for a job for someone that needed it or providing assistance and direction when someone's life was a bit adrift.
I think he's a very decent man to begin with. And he has helped his family members, all of them. He has reached out to friends that in need. He has contributed to causes that is not related to him or to his business. As I said, he's a very decent, very giving man. I think that has enriched his soul and being. As I said, he's very evolved and involved at all times.
He was also genuinely concerned with other folks, my well-being and whether I was enjoying myself and whether I was on a good path career-wise.
So with this focus on living enthusiastically and the notion that the last 30 years of your life could be the best, I wondered, how do you balance that against a time in your life when you're inevitably losing friends and family?
The key group of people that you're losing, people you have loved very much, and people that you've been, you know, very long, long-term. My friend Layla, who I've known for 87 years. I think you become very special. You become a very mature person, and you realize we are here. We have our passage through this, and you accept the fact that they have come, and they have spent their time here, and done what they thought best to do. But I know that you do accept the fact that we are here, and we will all be going. Your friends, your family, they die or they go into retirement places or something. They drop out of your life. You have to replace them with younger people. And you replace them with younger people by doing things that younger people are doing, and you meet them.
And so what can we learn from David Letick at 91? It seems that wholesale change every so often is good for the soul, as David happily leaped from Navy officer to ballet dancer at the Met to creative director for Revlon to prolific author. Yeah, that's one thing. Perhaps another is when you do what you want in life, but you marry it with decency and compassion for others, you end up with a life with few, if any, regrets. However, for me, the most intriguing thought was this.
Maybe the last 30 years of your life are the best ones.
Why can't your last 30 years be the best? Think about that. If you come to really believe that is true, it opens up a world of possibilities for you. Many people just kind of assume that the last decades of their life won't be as exciting or rewarding or fun or interesting as the earlier ones. But just because these ideas are generally held to be true, doesn't mean that they are true. Whenever you hear or see something limiting or dismissive about people your age, whatever your age, ask yourself, is that true for me? Whenever we get there, believing that the last 20 or 30 years of our life could be the best can't help but infuse enthusiasm into our lives. Enthusiasm is an important characteristic. It's contagious. If you're enthused about where you are and what you're doing, it shows. And people want to be around you.
Not many people have sex on their 90th birthday.
Not many, David. I'm Leslie Gold. Thanks for listening to A Life's Story. Hi, it's Leslie. As I create these episodes, I can't help but think of my own parents. They're gone now, and I wish I did this with them. I'd give just about anything to hear them tell their stories in their own voices again. And I thought, well, that's a service worth providing. So now you can get the full life story treatment for your loved one. We capture the life story of an important person in your life, say your parent or grandparent, and create a beautiful piece of audio storytelling that they will love and that you will treasure. You'll be proud to share it with your family, one day your kids and your grandkids. And the personal audio pieces include all the bells and whistles you hear in the podcast episodes. We do in-depth interviews, we score with music, use historical sound, we build a story arc, provide professional narration, and add additional voices. These pieces come out beautifully. And speaking from personal experience, one day you'll be really glad you have it. We are creating personal love stories too. So go to alifesstory.net for more information. alifesstory.net. You can book a call with us from the site, and we can discuss who you have in mind for a personal project in a totally no pressure call. alifestory.net.